The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest from the worlds of media, marketing and commerce. For today's show, I'm delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire COO, Lindsay Rountree. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here again.
Always a pleasure to have you. And as our special guest this week, I'm really pleased to be joined by Charlie Glynn, who is the ad technology leader for Channel 4 Sales. Charlie, really glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to this.
No, it's great to have you on. And it's fallen on a good news week for stories for your aspect of the industry. So I will kick us off and get your take on these. First off, good news for Netflix. Netflix was the most watched TV service in the UK for 3 months last year, overtaking the dominant domestic network, BBC One, for the first time. Viewing figures released by Barb, the UK's official ratings body, showed that Netflix's audience reach overtook BBC One in September, October and November last year, with Netflix's average audience reach for that period standing at 43.2 million compared with BBC One's 42.3 million viewers. We've talked a lot about the streaming sea change and what's going to happen in the industry with streaming services. This is a big one. This is quite big news for the industry. Charlie, I'm going to throw it to you first. What do you make of the figures? How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think firstly, the fact that Netflix have joined Barb so that figures like this can exist is really positive, right? And just to kind of clarify for any of the listeners on the looking at the figures of audience reach, that's specifically the number of people watching a TV service for three consecutive minutes in a month. So obviously lots of different measures out there, but this is the one that's pulled out as part of kind of Barb. But I think from my perspective, this is positive. Like Netflix, you know, are doing a good job of getting return behavior, whether that's, you know, that might be churn or people coming back anyway. So I think that is a positive thing. That's good for video and TV in general. I think the second point for me is that it's no big surprise that actually the patterns that you see with consumer habits and behavior is similar in SVOD that we've seen in broadcast over the years, right? Which is, it is cyclical. There's a big push in viewership, especially as we go into autumn and you know, the nights are drawing in and people want to sit down in front of, you know, the big screen and have a look at great content. So I think you know, there's a lot of similarities there, and you see actually I know in the article it talked about the strength of what happened in December for both all the broadcasters and some of the streamers as well. I think that also goes to show that the content scheduling there is also mirroring what broadcasts have typically done and planned ahead with. So I think there's some similar patterns there, but I think in general just shows the power of the BBC, to be quite frank. To be quite clear, that the comparison here isn't a complete like for like, which, you know, we are looking at a single channel here, just BBC One versus the entire catalogue of Netflix, like the entire catalogue. That's, you know, and I know the Ampere Analysis team had some great slides in some recent conferences about the content hours that existed across all the streamers and the broadcasters, and there's still a lot on Netflix. So the fact that BBC One is holding strong is really positive there, and actually speaks to the strength of them. But also the fact that it's appointment viewing led rather than on demand, you know, that is a very different experience. And I think it talks to the strength of the content that exists there, because yes, BBC One has a prominence advantage, you could argue, but even in the future, kind of from an IP related perspective, people are still going to have to click on just as many kind of buttons to get to their TV guide or EPG as they will do to an app. So I think it's a really positive, it's a positive one for Netflix, like kudos to them. And I think it is, again, I think it speaks to the strength of BBC and the fact that it's just BBC One that has a reputation for having that much scale and viewership behind it.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting take that we've got this article backwards. It's not that Netflix is in the position of strength here and it's overtaken the BBC. It's like, oh crikey, BBC One can handle Netflix on its own. That's a really good take that I'm really interested in. Lindsay, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I think drawing on what Charlie just said, for me, I was just quite astounded that BBC One specifically had such broad reach. I don't think I was really quite aware of just how big the reach was for BBC One. But I do think that and again, Charlie did like touch on this. I do think that if like the wrong headline was sort of pulled out of it, in the sense of, I get that it's a big headline to say Netflix beat BBC One, but Netflix is nowhere near beating the BBC. And as the BBC themselves pointed out, BBC One is just one channel. It's a broadcast channel. We're trying to adopt the digital first approach. Most of our comedy and drama episodes are day one drop, so everything kind of gets released at the same time. And, you know, and there's very few people that would compare a channel to a streaming platform. They might compare, I mean, my dad, but he's a terrible example. He asked me the other day what channel Squid Game's on, and I had to say it's on Netflix. And he's like, oh yes, of course, it's that channel. So there are some people out there that think of Netflix and probably Amazon Prime as a channel rather than a platform or a service. But I think that the more interesting chart for me, this was an article from Deadline pulling on Barb's number, the more interesting chart for me was comparing Netflix to ITV as a whole and Channel 4 as a whole and BBC as a whole, and looking at where Netflix compares with that, because there are some months where it overtakes Channel 4 and ITV, some months where ITV and Channel 4 are kind of a much more competitive. And again, as Charlie said, it's down to the broadcast channels that are still, you know, I guess, trying to get their eye in when it comes to really understanding how to become streaming platforms. You know, when we've had ITV in the past, as I said, we're not, you know, ITV Hub is not a BVOD platform. It's a streaming platform. And that's how they want to be categorized. And Charlie, I'm interested in getting your thoughts on kind of how you deem Channel 4 to sit within that as well. But I think that when you compare those as platforms, as streaming, as entire services, it's very interesting to see that Netflix is playing a really good role in that, and kind of really has really managed to up its game in terms of the content it's producing. But it's also interesting to see from the traditional broadcasters that exist in the UK. So obviously, I was again referring to BBC, ITV, and Channel 4 as the main three. How they have their peaks and troughs, and kind of if you watch any broadcast TV, you can go, oh well, that would have probably been I'm a Celebrity, that would have been kind of the Christmas specials, that would have been Love Island, that would have been this, that would have been that, and they're used to that. They know what they're doing. They know kind of where they're going to get those peaks and troughs, and they plan accordingly. I imagine Netflix is trying to find a way of fitting into that groove as well. So where it knows ITV goes down over the course of the autumn, it will try and put things on to try and kind of take some of that viewership. And that, for me, I think is what's very interesting. And I think that, yeah, as you know, Charlie was bringing sort of the positives out of this and saying it's a great thing for Netflix, but also it does show actually a really positive story for the kind of traditional broadcast channels in this country too. And I think that's where I find it the most interesting.
Yeah, Charlie, from your Channel 4 point of view, what do you make of it?
Yeah, and I think it's the content piece is really interesting, right? Because Netflix growth and kind of, let's say, linear decline, or, you know, let alone kind of looking at portfolio growth, because I think it's worthwhile noting that a lot of the content, whilst it might be unique to each of the streamers or any of the broadcasters or anything, you know, I know that Netflix are obviously trying a lot out in live with the different, I'm going to say, Tyson Paul event and, you know, NFL and everything. But there's a lot of content that actually might start on some of the public service broadcasters, like then get shared and with agreements with the production houses and things. You know, we certainly saw firsthand with the likes of Derry Girls, huge hit on Channel 4, and then went even bigger when it went on to Netflix, and we actually saw a lot of people kind of coming back to watch more episodes on Channel 4 as well on our app. So it's kind of not necessarily always at the compromise of the other platforms, I think, some of that growth. But I think to your point, Lizzie, the looking at the stats for the entire portfolios is really important, and looking at it from an on, like, and what I mean by that is more of the on demand, that is a bit more of a like for like. Because I think if you look at the Barb figures for the minutes, for the kind of volume of viewing minutes, if you think the 16 to 34 age groups are the ones that we know are moving away from linear the fastest. So this is kind of the worst case scenario, but that age group we saw last year, BVOD was up 9% year on year, and SVOD was down 1%. Now that is just one stat, but kind of goes to show that when you, there is a, there's a very different story all of these that stats can tell, I think, and it's important, you know, that, like you said, it's a, it could be a bit of a clickbait and a bit of a misleading headline if you look at it on first view, but there's a lot of more information and insights to get from the stats that are coming out of Barb and the different behaviours that we're seeing happen. So I think overarchingly it's a positive one, I think, for me.
And like from a measurement perspective, Charlie, like Barb has obviously over the years had a bit of a bad rap in terms of how it's measured, certainly kind of trying to bring the digital services in and compare them to linear channels. Do you feel like that's leveling out now and actually is in a good place and we can be more not trusting of the figures they're putting out there, but we can kind of look at it and go, yeah, that feels quite reliable?
I think so, yes. I think, you know, there's a reason it's existed for so long and it's been a not only a kind of a single, you know, a good source of measurement for and the gold standard for us as broadcasters in a linear world, but it's also acting as something that unifies that across digital. And I think that, you know, whilst it may not be perfect and lots of people may have different opinions on it, it's something there that provides consistency. It will, I think, inevitably always be improved on and be evolved as viewership, the data that exists and everything like that can also evolve. So I think it definitely plays a really important role.
Yeah, I think so. We had Rich Brandt from Vivo actually on a video interview this week, who was, we were talking about the need for standardization in a fairly fragmented CTV landscape. Do you think, you know, this, you know, as we've mentioned, Barb, do you think there's a need for increased standardization in measurement across the platforms?
I mean, yeah, definitely. And I know Rich has really led the charge, particularly with the fact that, you know, Vivo is so heavily concentrated with YouTube. You know, it's a really, really important thing for them. I think building that the more digital platforms and kind of streamers into a standardized kind of framework, whether that's fit for TV or anything else, in terms of that measurement, I think it's really important because it does help to tell a better picture. Like this, you know, these Barb stats are really important at telling us one part of the jigsaw, but it's not the whole pie, and it's misleading to think that it's telling you the whole story. But I think so. The more publishers and streamers, you know, broadcasters that are part of kind of unified measurement or different ways of looking at this, I think the better, because it will tell us more of the story of what's going on and user habits. And there's obviously a lot of other kind of sources of information for it. You know, we've got Channel 4 doing our next Gen Z report coming out shortly about the behaviours and habits and what people are really watching in those kind of then generations, because obviously we know they're so different. So that's that, you know, that might be more of a qualitative kind of study and a bit more insight driven versus necessarily the quantitative stats. But I think you need a bit of both to start to understand and where parts of this industry are really moving, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. You mentioned their user habits, and I'm going to use that as a little jump off to move on to our second story, which we're sticking with. We're sticking with streaming as well. And at CES this year, Disney revealed that the company's ad-supported monthly active users have reached an estimated 157 million people globally, including 112 million domestically, that's US and Canada, over the last 6 months. So, yeah, this brings us kind of away and into the ad-supported question. Charlie, what did you think about this and what does it tell us about consumers and their viewing habits regarding ad-supported services?
Well, I think as a kind of a call out, really, this for me, in slight contrast with the Netflix article, actually, Disney are really calling out the fact they're trying to be very transparent about the measurement they're using. Just as a slight side note, because I think theirs, rather than 3 continuous minutes, it was 10 seconds, but then multiplied on estimated viewers accounts. And, you know, it gets complicated, but, you know, I think the transparency around that just as a side note, was quite a big one, I think, for me. But I think for me, it kind of highlights a successful move from a subscription-based model to an advertising-funded model, I think, is quite interesting from a consumer perspective, because it shows how the success of it can be very specific to the publisher or the content owner themselves. You know, they were in the same boat as Netflix in terms of going from subscription to advertising. And I think, you know, the Netflix adoption figures of that have been more around the 10%, and then I was reading that Bob Iger accidentally revealed in November that the figures for this proportionally is probably more around 30% for Disney. So I think it's really interesting to see how these two massive companies have done the same shift and seen different levels of adoption. But I think there is quite a big difference, because I think the consumers are probably more welcome to some of those changes. You know, firstly, if you've got really strong content that's interesting and speaks to you as a consumer and as a viewer, you know, and with that, you know, Disney obviously have their wonderful catalogue of brilliant nostalgic films and new things coming out, but also the ESPN sports side, very diverse portfolio for them, but again, very different audiences with very strong affinity to the areas that they offer. So I think that kind of that strong content is a big one. Secondly, it's easy to find. Their brands make it really easy to identify and say, like, that's where I go for this type of content. And I think that, given the amount of choice that, you know, a viewer has, and I think everyone's had that kind of choice paralysis when you're searching for something to look at, to watch, right? So I think the fact that they both offer that ease kind of adds to something that really makes that shift easy. And the last one really is the fact that it's reduced that financial barrier for a lot of people, which at a time right now, I think is very important for a lot of people. And an advertising model really does enable that flexibility. You know, with some of the sports content, it might be only the one-off kind of types of games or things that people want to go and watch. And so I think by moving to that model, it almost retains the brand value that they've got with some of those, whilst letting people come back at the frequency they might want to, and that ultimately kind of retains them coming back to them as a content provider. So I think it just supports the efficacy of the advertising model, which is obviously one that Channel 4 has always had. But I think that's why it's really been pretty strong for them in comparison to other streamers that have done the same kind of move.
Yeah, Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with everything that Charlie said. And I think that it's interesting because, as Charlie already highlighted, like, Disney have done a better job of getting people onto the ad-supported tier than Netflix did, certainly when they first launched. I found some stats somewhere, let me see if I can do them out, which was over the first 3 months of Netflix going ad-supported and Disney going ad-supported, Disney Plus saw in month one, 15%, in month two, 18%, and in month three, 29% of new subscribers opting for the ad-supported plan over the fully paid plan. Whereas Netflix was only 9% in month one, 15% in month two, and 19% in month three. And there is a stat somewhere, I'm not sure how easily well this is verified, but apparently approximately 3% of Disney Plus subscribers are on ad supported compared to 1% of Netflix subscribers. And again, you wonder about kind of the logic behind that. Is it because people kind of tend to think, well, I spend more time on Netflix, so actually I'd rather go for the full SVOD approach on that one, whereas Disney, I don't use it so much, so I do use it, I don't mind.
Yeah, were they more likely to leave anyway, yeah, potentially? Like, were they closer to that decision? Yeah.
Exactly. So again, it kind of begs the question of kind of what the viewing habits are, because obviously with Amazon Prime, you have no choice. You pay and you also now get is now also ad-supported. And I'm just fascinated by, from the perspective of the streaming platforms, and Charlie, you'll have a perspective on this as well, which I'm interested in, because obviously you have the Channel 4 streaming platform as well, is what are they looking for? Obviously, from a linear perspective, the challenge of linear TV here is that it might cause brands to go, well, I'm going to invest less in linear ad funded in linear advertising and go and invest in the streaming platforms instead, because I might get richer data, I might get a better audience, et cetera, I can be more targeted. But from a streaming platform perspective, would I rather have a higher proportion of people that pay a little bit of money and also bring in advertising revenue for me, or fully pay a subscription, a subscription model? And, you know, for example, Channel 4, ITV Hub, they do it whereby you can pay to remove all ads, or you can just use it for free and see ads supported. And the annual fee is not very much. I think, for example, for Channel 4, it's like 40 quid a year or something. And I'm just fascinated by what people are looking for, because the average revenue per user must differ vastly on the kind of, like, if I'm only kind of watching it on ad supported model versus watching it with subscription. Arguably, you've got more regular revenue coming in from subscription, but the ad supported side of things might well end up, depending on what kind of advertisers you've got in play, might end up bringing in a very, very different level of revenue. So I'm going to stop talking because I really want your perspective on that, because obviously you'll be more in the weeds of that than certainly I am.
No, I don't mean, I think it goes back again to what is it that your content is really offering the view, you know, and, you know, I feel like, you know, all the broadcasters, but I feel especially with Channel 4, like there is such a strong sense of values. We've got a very strong and very clear remit as a public service broadcaster. You know, we're championing unheard voices. And as a result of that, that all feeds into the type of content that you will find. So you will go to content that, you know, the UK audience goes to content that matters to them because it speaks to British culture. You won't get some of those conversations, some of that content necessarily on those aggregators, because on some of the streaming aggregators, you'll see much more content that might be more applicable or resonate more with a much wider audience because they are global, or maybe they are looking for more kind of different types of entertainment. And I think that ties in with what matters to an advertiser as well. And I don't think it even matters whether it's over a linear broadcast signal or an internet one. I think it's very much about the composition of the streamer or the broadcaster or whoever's providing that content. I think that is probably one of the biggest draws for a lot of people. And I think that does then mean, combined with maybe more of the kind of the financial and the flexibility elements that we kind of talked about, I think that is probably one of the biggest bits that draws people in to go back and makes the value exchange of whether they're paying up front with a subscription or whether they're paying by watching adverts becomes a little bit becomes, you know, more negligible to them as a consideration point. I think the content and the purpose of what people are watching sometimes will always win.
Yeah, I think so. And as Lindsay said, you know, it's really great to have your take on this from directly being involved in the industry. Lindsay, do you think that the future of linear TV is bleak? I think we've had a couple of stats today that have said it's not really. How do you feel?
I mean, I don't necessarily think it's bleak. I think we just need to accept that it's evolving, right? Like, and because if you're a traditional broadcaster, from where I sit, looking at traditional broadcasts and how they're operating, they are operating in both a linear and a digital world, and they are trying to kind of make the best of both worlds. And I think that that's just, we have to evolve and we have to understand how consumer habits are changing. And we can't kind of watch the likes of Netflix and Disney and Amazon completely wipe the floor with linear TV and go, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to sit here and take it and make it affect our business. We have to learn to adapt. That's been the kind of the plight of the publisher for as long as I can remember. Like, you have to kind of learn to adapt to what's happening around you. And I think that that's what's happening with linear. There's still a place for linear. You know, it used to be that you'd say the place linear is sports. That's now changing quite dramatically and quite quickly as well. So that's making things look very, very different, but there is still a place for it. And I think the fact that certainly going back to the first story, the BBC One viewing figures in December, where it managed to trump Netflix quite comfortably, because it had, like, there's so much great live television, not live television, but linear television that comes on during the Christmas period, for example. There's always going to be those opportunities to, like, Christmas specials and that kind of stuff. Those opportunities for linear to be able to take advantage and take the lead. But I think we're just operating in a world where it's evolving. Bleak, I think, is unfair, because I think it's just, it's the next stage of what TV generally looks like.
It's dramatic, isn't it?
It is dramatic. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also, it kind of doesn't matter. Like, linear is literally the technology of delivering a broadcast signal. You know, that, you know, and that happens to, in terms of the way that surfaces in front of someone watching the TV, it's just that it's something that they can get to easily by going to a TV guide. Now, obviously, moving to digital, which is naturally happening anyway, it's a natural evolution, like you said, Lindsay. Like, this isn't a big surprise that's caught everyone out. You know, we had our Channel 4 target for digital revenue has been 30%, which we're hitting this year within, you know, a couple of years. So I think it's definitely been something that's been fully prepared for, and that the technology of linear broadcast signals will decline. We obviously know that it's still massive. I mean, case in point with the Netflix and BBC One, but Barb measurement, but it is changing and it is dropping. But I think it's more about that we still have appointment viewing, because that's exactly really what Fast and Freely and all these other services kind of offer. It's still lean back. You kind of get served what's, you can watch whatever is put in front of you rather than have to just select it. But you have this wonderful addition of being able to go to different, to the maybe potentially the same services, but on demand, like, and choose what you want to watch. And then there's the added benefit of it being blended, because you've got, you know, in terms of release schedules, you've got entire box sets being released all in one go. So technically, yes, it's on demand, but it's, you could call it appointment viewing, as well as all of the live, you know, all the changes that are happening with different people taking on live sports, like you say, and everything. So I just think I don't think it's bleak. Linear broadcast will decline, because that is a technology signal. And I don't think it can be used interchangeably, as sometimes it is with, you know, with broadcast kind of content and viewership, basically. But I think it's a really exciting time at the minute, I think. And I think, like you said, Lindsay, everything's evolving. And it's just coming into its kind of next stage, I think.
Yeah, well, excellent. And, you know, it's such a rich area for us to be keeping an eye on this year. I'm sure we'll keep up with you throughout on it, Charlie. I'm going to move on to our third story, which is, Meta. What a couple of weeks. Sigh.
Been quite quiet.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just...
Keeping the heads down, cracking on between 25.
So, we'll go with the DEI story. Meta has decided to terminate its DEI programs and claiming that the company is implementing these changes because of legal and policy landscape surrounding diversity, equity, inclusion efforts in the United States is changing. Meta will no longer enact specific diverse hiring practices. It will also end its equity and inclusion training and disband a team focused on DEI. As we've said, big start to the year for Zuckerberg. You know, he's removing fact checkers completely and welcoming what that brings, and then also now removing DEI. To quote him, that the term has become loaded. What do you think about this, Lindsay? Is this move damaging? What can we read under the hood of this?
Well, I mean, I have many, many thoughts, which probably goes without saying. I think that, first of all, I mean, Zuckerberg seems to be going kind of full Elon at the moment. So first, like, he cited Twitter, X in his reasoning for removing fact checking. He liked the way that the X obviously does the community comments, so it's kind of verified by the community rather than actually having a team actually going out and doing the fact checking. And now he's gone down removing the DEI program, which obviously Musk has done across his companies as well. Need to point out as well, like, it's not like Meta, the first company or second company to do this. Like, McDonald's and Walmart actually did this as well. And there's been a lot of bigger companies that have done the same thing. And their reasoning is Trump. Their reasoning is the kind of the policies that are surrounding diversity and inclusion, where the Republican Party don't believe it's effective, don't believe it works. Basically, what Elon's stance on D&I is how they, like, it prioritizes race, sex, and sexual orientation over merit. And my big point here is, and I feel like, you know, Meta going down sort of a similar route to this, especially given what they've removed, like all the different kind of teams they've removed their head of diversity, they've removed different buying from diverse suppliers. That's all been taken away. It's all getting completely nixed. It's not like they're I'm interested to know what's going to happen next, but I also want to understand what we mean by merit, because I think that's going to play a big role, like actually removing all D&I and just kind of focusing on the merit. Like, What are we classing as merit when you're getting a job, when you're trying to hire somebody? And I recently watched a documentary about the hiring process in America called Big Persona, and it's basically around trying to the kind of excessive use of personality tests, like Myers-Briggs, for example, in the hiring process, not just in like senior roles, but also if you're going to work behind the till at McDonald's. Like, it's being used everywhere, and kind of how damaging it is, and actually how Myers-Briggs even came about. If you can find it anywhere, I saw it on Sky in the UK, but it was really interesting. And I generally have an issue around hiring practices like this anyway, because when I was 18 years old and trying to find a job over the Christmas holidays back when I went back home during university, I tried to get a job at M&S, which, for those that don't know, it's a department store / kind of supermarket. Tried to get a job at M&S, and I had to do an online, an over the phone kind of if a customer came up to you and said this, would you do A, B, C, D or E? And I completely failed it. And I was like, okay, well, fine. What I felt like I did really good answers, couldn't work out why I failed it. And then that Christmas, I was in a local M&S and I saw somebody who I used to work with at Bird World. And for those that, Bird, if you're ever in the Hampshire, Surrey area, I would like a lovely day out. Bird World is, and you like birds, Bird World's the place to be. Quite expensive, but it is a good day out. But I used to work with her and she used in the restaurant there, and she used to eat the food off of people's plates after they finished eating them. So when she was in the washing up room, she would just eat the food off their plates. And I saw her working behind the till at M&S and I was like, well, you know, what did she answer to get this job when I was completely like just left out in the cold? So I've always had a problem with her. That's one of those kind of like traumatic experiences that will stay with you forever kind of thing. It was a good over 20 years ago and it still affects me to this day. So that's why I don't trust hiring policies like this anyway, because there's so much room for error, maneuver, whatever else. But I think that by removing the kind of aspect of D&I and focusing on merit, you're looking at, well, actually, if you're trying to like create products that target everybody, not just your average white man, how can a non-diverse, how can a homogenized workforce do that? How can they develop products? How can they innovate? And how can they understand their market? They can't, and they might even lose investment because many investors are trying to focus on investing in diverse companies. Like, there's just so many challenges to this. I appreciate there's probably some leveling out happening because they're trying to understand where Trump's going to go with this and kind of what that's going to look like, and they'll kind of row back. But by doing this in the US, are you also applying those rules to the UK, where we are, you know, hilarious having Charlie on, you know, Channel 4, one of the biggest proponents for diversity in the country, probably. Kind of your thoughts on this will again be fascinating, but I don't understand how this then applies to the rest of us in other parts of the world and how it applies to their hiring policies. Will this be blanket across everything? Is it just the US? It feels like it's going to be blanket across everything. There's just so much. It just seems really, really messy to me. And I wonder what they will do instead.
Yeah. Charlie, what do you think?
Yeah. There's a lot to unpack here, isn't it? Like you said, I mean, coming out with, you know, in quick succession as well, these two big changes. I think firstly, just touching on the DEI piece, I think it's really sad. I don't believe I exist in an echo chamber. I think there are plenty of people that understand and truly believe that the diversity that comes from having a diverse organisation and that's inclusive and all of those kind of things not only benefits a company culturally, but also, you know, as a kind of from a general business and financial bottom line. I truly believe that. I think, like you say, but Channel 4 is very much about diversity. And I think the big thing, I think the big difference here, I think, is also, and not to say that they aren't, but I think the authenticity of these programs and initiatives is really important. And like you said, it comes down to, you know, there's a challenge there in what they're saying about judging on merit. What does that actually mean for a lot of people? And I think the authenticity of programs is really important. You know, Channel 4's got some brilliant ones, like, you know, Black in Business and supporting Black-owned business entrepreneurs, because there is a very recognisable challenge to these entrepreneurs compared to the rest of society. So it's like doing it for specific reasons and not just as a talking point. And I think that's an important part, because when it comes to making these types of decisions, and we'll ignoring the political interference, I say interference here, but political impact on this, if it's not done with that authenticity in mind and actually trying to, you know, and seeing it delivered, then it's you can easily see how people don't see a financial or a benefit, cultural benefit to doing these, making these kind of initiatives actually come to fruition. So I think the authenticity around these initiatives is really important. The fact checking, I think, is equally quite scary. I actually listened to the Joe Rogan podcast that Zuckerberg did, because I'm just quite interested to hear, like, what is the opposite point of view that they're pushing out about kind of why this is happening. And I think the overwhelming feeling I just had from that was just the the overwhelming feeling about the political intervention here and the point of avoiding excessive censorship, which is so far from what I think everyone is that I'm aware of or reading about is seeing as the outcome. Like none of this is talking about positive impact on censorship that I'm seeing. And I think that those big differences make the fact that the positive reasons that they say they're doing this aren't even being mentioned, as the first responses, I think is something that's there's a misalignment there, which I think is quite interesting. And I think if anything, it just kind of, it reiterates, I think for me, about the significance of those kind of trusted sources of information. Especially when it comes to kind of finding the facts and everything. And obviously that's where, Channel 4 as a PSB kind of comes into play. But I think also, you mentioned it, Lindsay, about these companies are playing a very significant role, particularly Meta, maybe not so much like McDonald's, but Meta in particular, they're playing a really important role as to how the evolution of technology is for the general consumer. And it's quite obvious, we see it with AI at the minute, that if you don't have that diversity at that foundation level fed in at the start, let's say into any kind of the large language models or anything like that, then there's nothing, you can't produce things that take that into account at a later date. And these are just going to get evolved and built upon as we go. So I think that for me is even more worrying, that the role that they're playing with technology and stepping away from that kind of focus on diversity is going to have an even bigger impact, let alone the impacts that we know that these, losing these types of initiatives and that kind of focus happens. But the authenticity of any of these, I think, is an important, a really important part in all of this.
I think authenticity is a big one, because I think it was the same article that we're talking about here, where they had gone and tried to have a conversation with the Facebook AI tool that has been purported as a black character, and they had a conversation about the creation of the character, and the AI tool responded saying, basically, it's quite crazy that I've been put as a black character, yet I've been created by white people. And if you can't even get, and again, authenticity is completely perfect, because they're putting out this persona of something that is completely inaccurate, completely. And again, you couldn't, and again, the article said, these AI tools have been known to lie or say the wrong thing, but they did look at the AI board at Meta was for white men. And I think the AI character said, I've been created by 11 white men and one Asian man or something like that, and I'm a black woman. That doesn't make any sense to me. How can I be created as a black person when there's no black people actually created me? And that kind of sums up this whole situation probably fairly neatly, actually, as to they're trying to put out this persona of being, look how diverse we are, look how AI tools even are kind of a black female, yet there's nobody in the background that actually has a clue what they're talking about or doing. And that really, really impacts the again, authenticity, impacts the ability to be able to talk to a market you're trying to communicate with. It doesn't make any sense.
No. I totally agree. I think both of the issues on fact-checking and the DEI practices at Meta, I think they're really concerning. I've read some other takes on it. There was one I read the other day that was saying that if you look behind what Zuckerberg was saying about the DEI initiatives, then it's not actually removing them. They're just taking a new form and another name. And I just don't particularly believe that. I don't think that's an interesting framing, but I just don't think it is necessarily the truth. I think it's also like a dangerous precedent across the industry. People do follow companies like McDonald's, like Amazon, like Meta, and if other companies see them using, these are the world's wealthiest companies using financial imperative as a reason to remove diversity programs, what is the rest of the world to think?
I think that in that, though, there is a real opportunity for some of these companies to truly stand behind what they've been doing and be proud of them and say that, no, we believe in them and they work. And I think that will be really interesting. But I think there's, I think it was McDonald's that reading in a few of the news sources that, they've been, they're potentially being sued by, groups that are against affirmative action for some of their programs. And I think I think it will really be interesting to see if there are many more companies that follow suit, either politically because of Trump coming in, or from these other types of lobbying groups. It'll be really interesting because that will really tell you, I think, how authentic some of their programs have been and how much they really stand behind them. And hopefully they defend them.
100%.
Yeah, would absolutely love to see that. Some companies coming out and saying, no, this does good, and, you know, do not be taken in and follow this lead from Zuckerberg, Musk, etc.
Yeah, and if you want to, you can always take the lead from Channel 4 doing a little stunt going around the Meta offices with a
that
big
was,
sign.
That was wonderful, yeah.
Saying we fat checked the Zuck out of our news.
I thought that was, we were discussing it yesterday as well. I think you did some social stuff.
Big shout out to our marketing team. They hit the nail on the head there.
Strong work, Channel 4. I would love to say some incredibly slanderous stuff about Musk and Zuckerberg, but I will leave it there for the sake of our legal team.
We'd like to see you next week, John.
So I will leave it there. But Charlie, thanks so much for coming on the show. That's been three really interesting stories to get your take on. And we'll look forward to having you back later in the year. Thanks again for the time.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
And Lindsay, thank you as always.
Pleasure as always.
I'll see you soon. And thank you all very much for listening.